Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
I look at Greece as a laboratory, and the Greek people are lab rats, and the idea is to see how far you can push them into poverty and unemployment and absolute deprivation and despair. I mean, virtually having nothing. How far can you push these people short of a national rebellion where you have a violent revolution and the government would be overthrown? How far can you go? And whatever they can succeed in doing in Greece, that's what's coming to all other countries. I mean, it's happening right now across Europe and America and Canada and the developed countries. But this is the plan. If they get away with it in Greece, they're going to do exactly the same thing, go as far as they can go, and all these other countries. Make them all look like Guatemala, Haiti, or Bangladesh.
We're all Greeks now. As columnist Chris Hedges said in a powerful op-ed commentary a week ago, echoing this week's opening remarks by our guest Stephen Lendman, noted author, syndicated writer, and media personality, describing what he thinks is headed our way from the global financial powers that are currently in the process of destroying Greece and its economy. Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree. This week's program once again focuses on the train wreck of democracy's collision with the global monetary oligarchy that is slowly but surely eating away the sovereignty of not only Greece, but all of the countries that have been forced into austerity to satisfy the tribute that's been demanded by the cabal of global central banks. Ellen takes another inside look on this unfolding tragedy. If it weren't so important, we'd surely find something else to discuss. But Greece is the canary in the coal mine of public affairs, and we're obliged to tell it like it is, in hopes of waking everybody up to the nature and seriousness of the spreading financial terrorism that's being conducted in the name of private interests in the guise of international institutions. But we'll be talking about other things as well, even uplifting things. For example, we'll have a visit with a supervisor from Santa Cruz County in California about how they're pushing back against the criminal actions of five big banks. And we also talk with an author and philosopher who has accomplished an almost remarkable feat, the logical conjoining of spirituality with the evolutionary dimensions of human economic and financial systems. Maybe we're on an encouraging path after all. And we'll hear from Matt Stannard about some myths about American entrepreneurs on the public banking report. But first, let's start with a short discussion with Ellen about some recent developments that provide telltale signs of how current private interest management of public money is not only undermining our future, but also our confidence and dependence on safe and efficient public infrastructure.
Our infrastructure was given a rating of D+ overall. So something needs to be done, and both political parties agree that something needs to be done, but what they can't agree on is where to find the money. But they could easily get the money just by printing it. In other words, by quantitative easing or by an issue of U.S. notes or even creating some trillion-dollar coins, all of which are legal. And the thing that people get upset about is they think it's going to be inflationary. But it wouldn't. First of all, we've seen with quantitative easing, they've already done $3 trillion worth of quantitative easing, and we haven't seen hyperinflation like everybody was screaming would happen. But we also haven't seen it stimulate the economy much because the money just went to the banks. So what
just
it
like
has done. Exactly. So what it has done for the banks is it's allowed them to, they get this very cheap financing, so they've been able to buy up all sorts of commodities. It's inflated the stock market, but it hasn't gone to infrastructure, which we desperately need, or services, all those things that the people in the economy need. it hasn't gone to. But it could. They could just direct it that way.
What you're suggesting is that they would go against the virtual requirement that government borrows its money from private sources instead of creating it.
Which, why? Why are we letting private sources create our money when it should be government? And the only reason we allow it, I think, is that most people don't understand that's what's going on. And if everybody understood it, or even they say if 10% understand something and get behind it, you've got a movement and you can actually make political change.
FDR, of course, did that with the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that, of course, turned everything around. These huge infrastructure needs, that has to be originated at Congress, doesn't it, the congressional level?
Yeah, I've read, and I think the real reason they don't do it, they say it's all about debt, but the people that are really opposed to it are the very rich people. So why are they worried about debt? You know, that's not their issue. What they want is they want to own it all. So they want to force government to sell it all off, just like happened in Greece. Mm-hmm. And you can see that because the plum things are the ones that they're particularly starving of financing, like, for example, Amtrak or the U.S. Post Office, the ones that are actually profitable, could be profitable if the private companies, the big corporations, could get their hands on it. And that's what they want. They want to force it.
Well, our guest, Stephen Lenman, is going to be talking a bit about Greece, but I think that what has happened there is just stunning and very troubling. But it's almost like you want to say, the game is over. We've lost. You know, the powers that be don't have any respect or any inclination to defer to democratic intent. So now in Greece, you know, who owns the country?
Well, people say it's Germany, but it's really not. I mean, it's not even Germany that's going to get the money, and it's certainly not the Greeks that are going to get the little bit of money that they've allowed their knees to be broken over. It'll go to the financiers, to the creditors, particularly the big banks. The ECB and the IMF. But
the IMF has said that Greece should have its debt reshaped to be more sustainable so they can keep paying longer, I presume. How come if the IMF says that they wanted Greece to have its loans reshaped, it doesn't happen?
I think that one good thing that has come out of this is that we can now see it's made it into an international issue. It's been all over the news. And we can see that the whole thing is corrupt. It doesn't make sense. And we pitted them against each other. So they're sort of exposing each other, exposing the fault of the whole system. But I heard a really interesting thing. It was actually Robert Scheer on a talk show. The question was, why is everyone trying so hard to hold the euro together? The Greeks themselves do not want to leave the euro. And why not? I mean, it seems so obvious to us, like, just leave the thing, go out and do your own sovereignty, do like the Argentinians did or whatever, go back to your own currency. But what Robert Scheer said was that it's a cultural thing, that we, the Americans, we're the people who left. We're all the, you know, people that got fed up with the European system and came to America to be free. So to us, it's very important to be individuals, to be sovereign, to do our own thing, to be capitalist. But in Europe, they really believe in solidarity. They're actually very socialist. Even Germany is very socialist, much more than we are. They would never want to go back to having as few services as we do, for example, public services. So it's sort of a mindset thing that's almost unpatriotic, you know, not to try to go for solidarity with all the other European nations.
So the momentum of tradition going against the common sense of practical monetary reform and financial reform, this is all a heavy political tension, isn't it?
Yeah, well, they probably have been cowed into submission, which I think was the idea. But what I think they could do still without leaving the euro is to nationalize the banks, which they should do anyway because the banks are bankrupt. And the banks will not willingly on their own make loans to businesses because they're afraid that there'll be bad loans. So, but if the government took them over, they can order the banks to make loans to everybody in sight, you know, to all those businesses that are actually viable businesses, that used to be viable businesses, and that would be, again, if they had the money, and to government itself, if they're allowed to do that. So make a lot of loans. That would get a lot of currency back into the system, digital. It'll all be digital currency. As long as it's a closed system, as long as it's trading within the Greek banking system, the money is always there. It never gets lost. It just transfers from one bank to another. So in order to get the liquidity, you can borrow back from the bank into which the money you just created wandered. The only problem is leakage from withdrawals, like a run on the bank especially is the worst, or transfers out of the Greek system. What they need is for the ECB to be providing them with euros, which they aren't doing. But what they can do, apparently, in the Maastricht Treaty, it says that they can take over their central bank's printing press. The Greek central bank has a printing press, too. Take that printing press and start printing euros if the ECB, if the central bank, is not doing their job. So then they have to go in front of some sort of judicial body and prove their case. But they could start doing it first and then prove their case later. I mean, they have a pretty good case. They have that Truth Commission that said that much of their debt was odious. It should never have been incurred. They have the IMF saying that they need some sort of relief. So anyway, I think they could stay within the Eurozone and still generate a lot more money just by making loans.
When the inevitable failure to meet its debt results in a complete breakdown of the economy, what happens then?
Well, my hope, but I don't know, would be that they're just playing for time as it is, and that at some point they will be set up to move over into the drachma, and then they'll shed their shirt and show their Superman T-shirt underneath and do what we all think they should be doing, which is start out on their own, be a sovereign country, issue their own currency, show it can be done by issuing a lot and spending it on social services and infrastructure and all those things that economies need.
Well, let's see what Steve Lindman says. Thanks, Ellen.
Okay. My guest today is Stephen Lindman, a writer, syndicated columnist, activist, news TV personality, and radio show host. His radio show, the Progressive Radio News Hour, began on the Progressive Radio Network, which is this network, in 2007. And he has recently done some hard-hitting pieces on Greece. Greetings, Stephen. It's so great to be talking to you.
Ellen, it really is a joy for me to be on with you.
What I really liked about your interviews, you're so supportive. I mean, you're really passionate about your views. You're passionate about Greece. Do you want to summarize in a nutshell what your sense is of what's going on there?
Oh, I've written sporadically about Greece since the troubles began there about 5-6 years ago, Ellen. And in my banker occupation book, Waging Financial War and Humanity, I had a chapter in it about Greece. And when the troubles with the Troika began again, after Tsipras began negotiations, which really weren't negotiations, it was just hard-hitting demands placed on him, giving him no choice, with a former prime minister who resigned. He said he resigned. I wonder whether it was a combination of resignation and being pushed out. So Yanis Varoufakis, former prime minister, he's written a couple of very hard-hitting articles, and he insists that he was the one who decided he wasn't going to put up with this anymore. So I have to go along with what he said, Ellen. But he said the pressure was intense. And when he was in negotiating sessions with the people in Brussels, I mean, he would make very logical, sensible arguments about what Greece needed and the fact that what was being put on the table for them to accept without any concessions would absolutely destroy the country economically. And he said, you know, they just looked at him with blank stares. It was like he was talking to the wall, not to other finance ministers, 19 finance ministers in the Eurogroup, the Eurozone or the Eurogroup, called them either one. And I guess he got so frustrated, getting very little sleep day after day after day. The trouble with the Euro system is to join all 19 countries, and really Germany is the dominant one, they basically make the rules, so much more powerful than any other country, and I think France probably number two, but I think there are disagreements between both countries. But you have to surrender your monetary and fiscal authority to join the group, so you have no control over your monetary and fiscal policy. You can't print money, you can't devalue your currency, you can't say we are in a dire situation. Like Roosevelt during the New Deal, and decided we need to institute social programs. Didn't do enough, but he did plenty, as opposed to today, where it's austerity instead of social programs. So all these things are beyond the power of what these countries can do. And Schäuble wants to go further. He wants the equivalent political power to go with the monetary and fiscal power. He didn't say it, but I'm sure he wants to not only be the financial czar of the Eurozone, but the political czar. You put it all together, he wants to be a dictator.
Yeah, and that's actually what these terms that they've agreed to, that's the situation they're in now, that their whole economy is a managed economy managed by the creditors. It's down to the details of what they sell off and when and so forth.
Oh, absolutely. And Schäuble has a personal financial interest in what's going on, Ellen. The €50 billion of Greek assets, I don't know what they'll be, enterprises or land or ports, whatever they'll be, they will be managed in Athens by a German bank that Schäuble has a financial stake in. So in other words, he's going to make money out of the management of Greek assets. I mean, the trouble with the euro system is Schäuble. I mean, you need to get rid of this guy to have any chance for something in any way more fair than the way things are now. But I never realized what a nefarious character this guy is. I mean, he's a toxic element in the entire system. He probably wants to replace Merkel. I think he and Merkel don't get along too well together. He doesn't want to listen to what she has to say. He wants her to listen to what he has to say.
Well, it seems to me they've totally abandoned, I mean, supposedly this is all in the name of free markets and neoliberalism, but in fact, what they've wound up with is a totally managed market. I mean, it's the same thing that they've done in the third world with when the IMF comes in and then imposes their austerity measures. But now they're turning it on the first world, and it seems to me the good of it is that it's now being exposed for us all to see, and we're feeling it because this could be us. I mean, they're coming for us next. So the very fact that it's pitted these various players against each other, I mean, it's made the whole EU sort of that, well, the IMF says that they can't afford to pay and that they need debt relief, and the EU is refusing. So they're all arguing among themselves, and it's all apparent for us to watch. It's big news for us to basically see how the system doesn't work and that this is what it comes to. This is what finance capitalism comes to. The fact that you allow, well, you know, my thing is that the problem is that the money is created privately, that they create it in the form of loans. The loans create the principal but not the interest, so they're always requiring more back than they created in order to pay the loan back. So necessarily you always have this parasitic drain away from the people into the parasite, which is the financiers, the creditors.
Oh, absolutely, Ellen. I think one of the most recent examples is the ECB, I think, approved or will approve a $7 billion bridge loan to the Greek banks, but about $6 billion of that goes right back to the ECB and the IMF to pay the due ECB bill due tomorrow, as a matter of fact, and the overdue IMF bill that was due on June 30th. So $7 billion to the Greek banks and almost $6 billion goes back immediately. They probably have something in mind for the other billion or so to take that back in some form. So what kind of a bridge loan is it when you keep at most a tiny portion of it? But I think you hit the nail on the head, Ellen. I think what's going on in Greece is just a prelude for what's planned for every place else, every other country where these financial terrorists could get their claws into. And I look at Greece as a laboratory, and the Greek people
right.
are lab rats, and the idea is to see how far you can push them into poverty and unemployment and absolute debt deprivation and despair. I mean, virtually having nothing. How far can you push these people short of a national rebellion where you'd have a violent revolution and the government would be overthrown? How far can you go? And whatever they can succeed in doing in Greece, and the thing is still in play, that's what's coming to all other countries. I mean, it's happening right now across Europe and America and Canada and other the developed countries. I don't know what's going on in Japan, maybe a little in Japan too, but this is the plan. If they get away with it in Greece, they're going to do exactly the same thing, go as far as they can go in all these other countries. Third world eyes them all, Ellen, and one of the things I like, the countries I like to point out, make them all look like Guatemala, Haiti, or Bangladesh.
So I think what Syriza achieved, if anything, although they've succumbed to a worse deal than if they had just gone along with the program in the beginning, is that they weren't supposed to rebel. I mean, they've put it out there for everyone to see what's going on. They put it to a popular vote, which was amazing. You know, they put it to a democratic vote, and the people said, no way, we're not doing it. Of course, they did it anyway, and you could argue about why they did it anyway. I mean, it seems to me, after listening to a lot of interviews and stuff, that they probably were forced into it. So they didn't actually help the Greek people, but what they did do was expose everything that's going on. So it seems to me it will be difficult for them to impose that on the world, because the world is on to them.
Well, I hope you're right, Ellen. My fear is that despite all the stuff going on in Greece and the stories and the headlines and even TV covers it to some extent, a lot of people are just oblivious. Their eyes glaze over. They don't want to hear about Greece. They want to hear about Emmy Awards and stuff like that. So I think people's eyes glaze over. In America, maybe Europeans are a little bit more savvy. Maybe Canadians are a little bit more savvy. But Americans just seem to be oblivious of how their rights are being destroyed. And literally, I mean, the force-fed austerity just in the 6.5 Obama years, I mean, just absolutely terrible as stuff has gone on. And I've written so much about it that and Medicare has been hammered, and they want to hammer Medicare a lot more than it already has been. I mean, this stuff is hurting people terribly. And real unemployment, as we both know, Ellen, isn't the phony, 5.5%. It's over 23%. When people aren't working for a certain number of months, they're not counting anymore. They become non-persons. So they go out of the system, but over 23% unemployment. I mean, this is depression-level stuff, and nobody talks about this.
The difference is it's kind of hidden. In the depression, you could actually see the bread lines that went around the block.
Yeah.
Now they're at midnight in Walmart when they go in with their food stamps. Very similar.
They go to food banks too, Ellen. I guess instead of soup kitchens, they go to food banks. And it's been a while since I've written about them, but I've written a couple of times where the food banks, I mentioned them briefly in an article, where the food banks are running short of food because the demand is so high, exceeding demand, exceeding supply. So it's a dismal situation in America. And I just can't figure out why Obama still has an approval rating that hovers above 40%. I mean, I can't imagine why anybody, except the people benefiting from his horrible policies, would support him, but they are. I mean, Bush went down close to 20% approval, and Obama still has an approval rating more than double he had. I was convinced that he would drop down to the Bush level before long, but it hasn't happened, and it probably won't. Plus, all the wars he's waging, spending money on wars and spending money on building the country, building infrastructure, giving people benefits that they need, and absolutely lurking behind the scenes in what's going on in Greece. We get the IMF involved.
Well, I think the reason people still support the government in general is that they watch TV. That's where they get their news. I used to actually do that, I have to admit, when I was a busy lawyer, housewife, mother. I would turn on the news for 5 minutes, and that was it. That was all I knew about what was going on in the day. So they get it spoon-fed from networks that are owned by the big banks, and so they get the party line pretty much. They don't see what we see because we have the time to explore all around. But it does seem to me that information is exploding. That is something totally different, is we now have the Internet. It isn't that all we know about things is what we read in the daily paper. We can look if we're curious, if we have a reason to be suspicious.
Oh, I agree, Ellen. I agree. And the only problem is it takes a little bit of effort to go online. In most cases, it means reading something. I don't think Americans like reading very much. If they read an article in the newspaper, they never should have bought in the first place, including the New York Times, the unofficial propaganda agency of Washington. I mean, people read a first paragraph or two and not read any more. And when the Times writes something of worth, it's buried about 20 paragraphs down.
So we're actually more brainwashed than Europeans anyway, I think. But anyway, my sense about whether they had an alternative, I've read that over half the economy is imports and that 75% of food is imports. And that's the immediate problem, was feeding these starving people, that the ECB actually had the power to cut off their money by saying, we're not going to backstop your banks. That's what I've written about, the fact that all banks need a central bank. They'll all be bankrupt if they don't have a central bank to back them up, because they all lend money they don't have, or money created out of thin air. But then they have to balance their books, so they have to borrow it from other banks. And if there are leakages in that whole system, as from bank runs, for example, then the ultimate backstop is the central bank, and if they don't have that backstop, we'll be insolvent. So that's the state that their banks are in now. So they don't have the money to buy the food. What if they switch over to the drachma? They're not set up for drachmas. It's not like in Argentina, for example, where they were already using the peso, but it was pegged to the dollar. So all they had to do was unpeg it. But their whole banking system was set up in pesos. There was no question how much money you had. It was all, the numbers were all the same. Whereas for the Greeks, they would have to start printing drachmas. They'd have to convert to drachmas. They'd be subject to all the short sellers who would be out to bring down the drachma. If they try to do a dual currency, the euro will prevail, no doubt, and they'll have to do capital controls, which I think would actually work. It worked for Malaysia. But I mean, I think it can be done, but I can see why they may have had an immediate problem where they had to go along. I mean, maybe arguably they're just going along until they secretly get the drachmas all set up, and then one day they'll say, April Fools, we're not paying, and we're now in the drachma. But I think
you're right, Ellen. And what an argument for public banking. I mean, public banking could avoid a lot of problems. And I agree with you also that the Tsipras was given no choice. I really believe he was given no choice. But I think it wasn't during the recent negotiations so much. I think during the negotiations, it was simply repeated and emphasized. I think the law was laid down to Tsipras right after his election. You know, the European countries in Washington didn't want him to be prime minister. They didn't want Syriza to be the ruling government. They wanted the right wing ringers to continue ruling Greece. So here you get a supposed social democratic administration coming into power. I think the law was laid down to him right at the start. You're either going to play our game or we're going to destroy you. And so I think he knew pretty well all along what the stakes were for him and for Greece and maybe even the threat of assassination. Who knows? I mean, these people play hardball all the way. They'll do anything. I mean, they'll go to war with Greece to get what they want.
Right. I totally agree. And in February, as soon as the Syriza party got elected, the ECB turned off the tap and put them onto their emergency funding, which is more expensive, and they could turn it off at any time. So they were immediately thrown into a crisis situation, and then you had bank runs after that. So I agree. And who knows what they do behind closed doors? And we know apparently that Obama was calling Merkel every day. I mean, who's calling the shots here? They've got to have their NATO set up, and they can't have Greece doing anything like negotiating with Russia and China.
The BRICS discussions between Tsipras and Vladimir Putin were about the possibility of Greece becoming a BRICS member, the sixth BRICS country, and a couple of Greek officials expressed an interest in that happening. Of course, nothing, at least so far, has come of that. But the five BRICS countries, China and Russia, of course, the two dominant ones. India, Russia dominant in a lot of ways. In India, the other real powerhouse. Brazil, a South American powerhouse in South Africa, and Greece would be the pygmy among these countries, but welcome. And this system is one of certainly a cooperative relationship as opposed to the Western way of doing business. And, I mean, they have a new development bank. I've seen different dates on when it's supposed to be started, but the bank is all set up, and if it hasn't opened for business yet, I think it will before too very long. So Greece could become a BRICS country, could have access to the bank for financing, could get direct funding, financing, or funding help from Russia or China. I think it's there for the asking, Ellen. But of course, Greece hasn't done that yet. I think they could get a lot of help from Russia and China. So I don't know. I don't know that things are as dismal as they seem for Greece, despite all the threats made. I remember when Iceland went its own way several years ago, before David Cameron became British Prime Minister, Gordon Brown was Prime Minister. He called the Icelandic leaders terrorists. You get out from under our system, you're committing a terrorist act. Well, Iceland just thumbed its nose at Gordon Brown and anybody else who might have made threats against the country and went its own way and went out from, prosecuted its banking crooks, restructured its whole system, and came out of it smelling like a rose. Tiny Iceland. So you got tiny Iceland, you got tiny Greece. If Iceland can do it, why can't Greece do it, Ellen? Iceland not a Eurozone country, so I guess they had their own currency. I don't think it's a Eurozone country.
Yeah, well, that is the difference. No, they weren't already with the Euro. They already had their currency. So I think it was easier for them. And plus, they just don't have all these pressures about keeping NATO together. I mean, you know, I imagine there are all kinds of horrible threats behind closed doors.
Oh, indeed. And I'll bet you they came from Washington, too, Ellen. And Cyprus can't be completely stupid about American history. It's a string of assassinated leaders or ones attempted assassinations on or who failed, like Fidel Castro, reportedly 500 times. I don't know how anybody survives 500 assassination attempts, but he'll be 88 years old in August, next month, I think 88 years old and still alive. Came back from a terrible illness some years ago, but Cuba proved that you could defy a Washington invasion, a literal invasion, Bay of Pigs, and come back and survive. I still think Greece could do it, Ellen, with all of the problems. And Cyprus had 6 months in office to figure out exactly the plan, how they were going to do this. Not a matter of saying that today we're going to go with the draft and we need a couple of weeks to get this straightened out. He had 6 months to come up with a plan. I honestly think that if Greece doesn't get out of the euro system, the country's economy is doomed. I mean, it's doomed right now. Only its obituary remains to be written. But it's just a terrible situation, and the Greek people are suffering so much, and they have no control over their lives, and the government has no control over its most important policies, and they're just beholden to whatever the powers of the troika want. You should call it a quartet rather than a troika, because Germany stands out as a separate power, so you got to add Berlin to Frankfurt, where the ECB is located, and you got to add Berlin too, because the German government, and again, they dominate what's going on in Europe. But unless Greece gets out from under this, it's just doomed forever. So, you know, do you want to stay imprisoned and stay alive, or do you want to risk all and a better future and get out from under the system and roll the dice and see what happens? If I was the Prime Minister of Greece, Ellen, I mean, I'm almost 81 years old, so what have I got to lose? But I never would have taken the job unless I had decided beforehand, despite all the risks, I'm going for broke. And if they want to kill me, they know where I am. They can come get me, but I'm going to do it anyway.
Yeah, I totally believe you're being honest in that.
I really am. William Blum, who wrote Rogue State, I think in an article he wrote once, that if he became president of America, on day one he'd do this, you know, all the good things that they would like governments to do for us. On day one he'd do this, and on day two do this, and on day three that, and on day four he'd be assassinated.
But I can see the point for Syriza to hold it together, because if they don't, they'll wind up with the bureaucrats. You know, bureaucrats will get appointed to take over if Cyprus is out. And so they'll be in the same situation as Cyprus, et cetera. So I can see why they want to try to retain power just to avoid the alternatives.
Well, I guess when they came into power, Ellen, they decided they didn't go through all of this campaigning and election and victory to give it all up. But again, my feeling is if you want a job, you ought to do it honorably and fairly and legally and the rest of it. And if you don't want to do it that way, then find a new line of work.
Well, that was evidently Varoufakis' feeling.
Yeah, and he decided he had enough. And the finance minister who replaced him, Euclid, I forget how to pronounce his last name, he was described in some reports about him as a Marxist. Who ever heard of a Marxist? A Greek coming up with a plan that gives the bandits in Berlin and Frankfurt and in Washington and Brussels everything they want. Who ever heard of a Marxist doing anything like that?
Well, and you keep hearing about supposedly socialist governments that aren't acting socialist at all.
Well, they call themselves socialist, but they're not socialist at all. Like the French government.
The
French government is a socialist government. Well, Carl, I'm sure, is rolling over in his grave just at the thought of using that terminology.
Well, I think the way they could have done it would be to continue using the euro and create money, as all banks do. I mean, what they'd have to do is nationalize the banks and take over the printing press of their central bank, which supposedly they're allowed to do under the Maastricht Treaty if the ECB doesn't perform its functions, and then they'd have to go to some sort of court and justify what they did. But it seems to me they could stay in the euro, at least as an interim measure, create their own money in the form of just start issuing a bunch of loans to all their businesses, or issue loans to the government, either one, and get the government spending or get the businesses hiring people again, making products again, which will put money in people's pockets so they can go shopping again, get the economy going. I mean, what they need is more demand. I think I saw Varoufakis said that when it was evident that these various Mediterranean countries couldn't possibly pay their debts, what they should have done was write down the debts. But then the problem with that is it means that the creditors have to lose some money. I mean, it's a haircut, either a haircut to the creditors or the Greeks have to, you know, if the Greeks don't pay, somebody else has to pay. But that's not actually true. The way our banking system works, the central bank, the ECB, could have bought up the debt and then just done like our Federal Reserve does, just let it sit there, rebate the interest to the government. You can roll over the loans, but you don't ever collect on them. So it's not a debt that anybody actually has to pay. So in effect, you've created the money to pay the debt, which the only harm of that is supposedly it's inflationary, but in the Eurozone at the moment, they need some inflation. That would definitely help the Greek economy. It would help the whole Eurozone.
What do you think about a dual currency system, drachma and euros?
It seems to me the only problem is that people would be always trying to trade in their drachmas for euros because they would figure the euro was the stronger currency.
Would it be possible to issue drachmas at a valuation equaling the euro?
Well, that's what I was thinking, that you could peg. I think that's what the Malaysians did. They pegged it. They pegged the ringgit to whatever, the dollar, I guess, and at a fixed peg. It's just like what the Chinese did for years and years. They pegged the yuan to the dollar. And then in Malaysia, what they did was, as you went into Malaysia, you could use ringgit while you were in Malaysia, and as you went out, you changed them back into your own currency. So you couldn't trade them outside the country, so that avoided short sellers selling them, etc. So they only actually traded within the country, but if you wanted to trade with Malaysia, you had to convert your currency at a fixed ratio into the ringgit, and that worked for them. Everybody said it wouldn't, and it did, and even the IMF agreed that it had worked.
So if I recall right, back in the 1997 and 8 financial crisis manipulated by the financial bandits in Asia, the Asian crisis, Malaysia stayed pretty free of that.
Yeah. Well, and apparently they were advised by some British money reformers who preferred to remain anonymous, but who were telling them that, you know, they could print their own money. And that it was Malaysia, it was Prime Minister Mahathir, who did the original Asian Monetary Fund, or attempted to set it up. So this whole idea of competing with the IMF, not buying into the IMF, he was a rebel to the IMF. And you could argue, I would argue, that that's the reason Malaysia has been hit lately with, who knows. But anyway.
Well, he bucked the system, and he lived to tell about it.
Yeah.
You know, there's always a danger. I mean, if you defy the authorities in Washington and Europe, there's a danger that your life might be shortened considerably. But there's also a possibility that you can beat them at their own game. There are examples that show that can be the case. And my feeling is that this is what should have happened in Greece, that Soha hasn't. And if Tsipras has a secret plan to prove that he really isn't a Judas after all, then I'm willing to forgive him if he unveils it at some point in the reasonably near future. I'll say all is forgiven, Alexis, if you'll finally do the right thing, even belatedly. But so far, he is not on my good list.
Well, even Malaysia already had the ringgit in place, and all they had to do was impose capital controls. So I can see where Greece has some harder issues to face. So, yeah, it remains to be seen.
I just wonder what will happen. Things just seem so fragile to me overall, Ellen. You know, we've got this money printing madness that's keeping Western economies afloat. I think at some point this game has to end. It's like musical chairs, and somebody's going to be left out in the cold. a musical chairs where all the chairs are taken away, and the whole system just comes crumbling down. A guest I had on my program, a regular guest for years, until sadly he passed away a few years ago, Bob Chapman, a former Wall Street insider, just predicted that this what's going on now simply can't be sustained. And the longer it goes on, the tougher it'll be when it finally comes apart. And I remember that he predicted it would come apart sometime, a wide range that he listed, sometime between 2012 and 2017. So we're getting halfway towards 2016.
Yeah, yeah.
So who knows? Again, the famous statement by Nixon's, I think, chief economics advisor, Herb Stein, who said, "What can't go on forever most?" That's one of my favorite quotes. What can't go on forever most? And what's going on now can't go on forever. And again, I mean, it's a dirty, unsustainable game. And we're going to have some bubbles exploding at some point. But again, who can tell when?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. It's been so great to hear you. I just enjoy listening to your voice. You're so lively and passionate.
Alan, it's a special joy for me to be on with you. And I mean, it makes me feel, instead of getting a year older next month, it makes me feel a year or two younger.
Right. Well, it's been so good, and I hope to be able to talk to you again.
Ellen, be well.
Oh, you too. My guest today has been Stephen Lenman, a writer, syndicated columnist, activist, news TV personality, and radio show host.
An encouraging beacon of governmental leadership and integrity has emerged on the horizon of California's Pacific Coast in Santa Cruz County, where County Supervisor Ryan Coonerty led a decision by the Board of Supervisors to curtail investment in five global banks, including J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, Barclays, Royal Bank of Scotland, and UBS, who recently pled guilty to federal felony charges. The county won't use the bank's investment services or buy their commercial paper for 5 years, and it will start putting its money out of those banks to the extent that it can. Supervisor Coonerty said that we have a sacred obligation to protect the public's tax dollars, and these banks can't be trusted. Santa Cruz County should not be involved with those who rigged the world's biggest financial markets. We asked Ryan Coonerty what motivated his initiative to act against these big banks.
Well, I'd say it's really sort of two parts. One part is, like most Americans and people around the world, it's just a frustration with the bad behavior by Wall Street, where they're continually caught doing something bad and then fined, and then the bad behavior continues. And this time, the fact that the charges were criminal, so it's not a case of just trying to settle to reduce legal exposure or legal costs. The standard for criminal guilt is beyond a reasonable doubt. So it's clear that in this case, there could be none of the normal excuses of just settling it to make the issue go away. So part of it was just outrage. Time when I was mayor of Santa Cruz and now on the board, I'm really interested in the idea of moving our money locally. So when I was on the city council, I led an effort to invest part of our reserve funds in local financial institutions, local banks and credit unions. And we're trying to do the same now at the county level. And so it's part of the spirit, I think, of what you're advocating for, which is let's move the money back closer to the people and back and in a way that benefits the community.
In Los Angeles, there was a study done by, I believe, SEIU and the AFL that looked at how much the city was spending in interest to Wall Street and in fees, and it was $230 million. And they pointed out that that's more money than the city spent on roads. And then, of course, they pointed out, as you do, the various corrupt relationships and practices of the city. And the council voted 14-0 to go back to the banks and say, look, renegotiate that debt and pay us back $65 million for, you know, what you've taken. Now, we understand that the banks came to them and said, look, you guys don't want to do this. We're going to make your life miserable, and we're going to raise your fees. You will raise your interest rates. Have you had any sort of response like that yourself from the big banks?
So I've gotten no response from any of the big banks to my initiative. And, you know, I think we're relatively small. I mean, we're $650 million portfolio, which is a lot of money, but I think by their standards is not much money at all. And so I think they were hoping that this be a small, we'd be a small outlier county and would just go away. And I'm hoping that now, as I'm getting calls and emails from elected officials and citizens from around the country, maybe we can get their attention.
Can you tell me what other towns or cities and counties you have been in touch with?
Sure. I mean, I think I've heard from elected officials in and around the Bay Area, city of Oakland, city of Modesto, city of Richmond, and then state legislators in Oregon and other places. And then also just, dozens, if not hundreds of citizens from around the country and, in fact, the world were just frustrated and glad that somebody is trying to take some action. The depressing thing is I think it shows how frustrated people are with the level of accountability that's been lacking towards these banks for a long time, so that this, what is a relatively small effort, means a lot. And it really, I would prefer if SEC or, you know, the large pension funds, you know, who really could change behavior would step in and engage. So one of the surprising things is the number of people who have written me from the financial services industry. You know, I sort of expected traditional liberal, you know, activists to like this, but the number of people, emails I've gotten from people in the industry has been remarkable, and I think they see it up close every day and are just as frustrated by it.
Santa Cruz County Supervisor Ryan Coonerty. On this week's Public Banking Report, Matt Stannard takes a look at some of our notions about the heralded independence of entrepreneurs.
I'm thinking about myths today. Not myths as in mythology, Greek mythology, for example, but America's grand narrative myths. Arguments about America and Americans in the form of narratives, archetypes, enduring object lesson-oriented stories. Such as rags to riches, the heroism of ordinary people, the genius of American inventors and their quirky beginnings. America tells itself the story that any weirdo can make it, not only to be successful, but also influential. And thing is, that's sometimes true. Those heroes and innovators do exist. Now, the reality is never as glamorous, nor the heroes quite as heroic. Think, for example, of some of Steve Jobs' labor practices. But people do some amazing things in this country, and in some ways our individualism has served us well. But recent research suggests that the most consistent trait associated with entrepreneurs willing to take risks is material privilege. And all of this is reported in Quartz magazine by Amy Groth in a recent nice tight piece entitled "Entrepreneurs Don't Have a Special Gene for Risk. They Come from Families with Money." Groth writes that what often gets lost in these conversations is that the most common shared trait among entrepreneurs is access to financial capital, family money, an inheritance or pedigree and connections that allow for access to financial stability. While it seems that entrepreneurs tend to have an admirable penchant for risk, it's usually that access to money, she writes, that allows them to take risks. She goes on to say that University of California, Berkeley economists analyzed the shared traits of entrepreneurs in a 2013 paper and found that most were white, male, and highly educated. If one does not have money in the form of a family with money, the chances of becoming an entrepreneur drop quite a bit. New research out this week, she continues, from the National Bureau of Economic Research, looked at risk-taking in the stock market and found that environmental factors, not genetic, most influenced behavior, pointing to the fact that risk tolerance is conditioned over time, dispelling the myth of an elusive entrepreneurship gene that many had earlier suggested. This rings true. You often hear entrepreneurs succeed by learning from failure. But if you don't have consistent access to capital, it's hard to get back on the horse. Now imagine, instead, if communities, localities, regions, states, could use the money that they already have to provide credit to promising startups, to people with ideas and a work ethic. Even a selective process would be better than the current reliance on private funding that so much entrepreneurship has, since private funding is contingent on the economy doing well. Public banks, on the other hand, can offer what are called countercyclical loans, or low-interest loans, what some call capital buffers, to keep supporting small businesses in bad times, of which, of course, there are many. Such a system wouldn't need to be irresponsible either. The managers of public banks would likely be on tight leashes by cities, counties, or states. The Bank of North Dakota, the nation's only full-fledged public bank, certainly doesn't lend irresponsibly. Criteria including creditworthiness is taken into account, but BND also supports community banks that broaden their criteria for their local communities, but also are careful in the way they lend. The point is, public banks would have a chartered mandate to grow local economies, and that's different than Wall Street's mandate to serve faraway shareholders. Public banks would have no incentive to make risky or shady loans like Wall Street lenders do. But for me, the argument for public banks and small business is pretty simple. Access to the grand American narrative of weird iconoclast innovators, bold entrepreneurs, the person with the earth-shaking idea, access to those things should not be an accident of birth. We should instead use our money to support our stories to be. I'm Matt Stannard.
With the challenges of increasing consolidation of monetary control threatening democracies the world over, there's good reason to reflect on how we intend to navigate and plan for our collective future. One public banking pioneer has created a philosophical framework for examining the elements of change. He's Robert Bowes, an author, economic historian, and philosopher who explores these topics on solomonsproof.com.
Are we at the time in human history where we're able to make a transformation into some new awareness around our relationship with money?
Absolutely. I think we're at our crossroads, and the choice is fairly simple. It's either evolution or slavery. And, evolutionarily speaking, we're basically on the verge of a major evolutionary step for humankind. And really, that involves overcoming the instincts and the ego and sharing with each other. And if we are able to do this, then we're in a situation where we can set up a more rational society, which includes public banking networks without usury.
Why are we at that stage now? What's different about now?
Well, I think that, as everybody's seeing, and Greece is a perfect example, you know, capitalism has just reached this stage where very few people at the top of the power structure are choking the planet for their own gain.
On your page, The Next Evolutionary Step, you have the pyramid broken down of what the contrast is between medieval feudalism and corporate feudalism. And at the very top of the pyramid, what used to be occupied by the monarchs is now occupied by central bankers, like presumably the ECB, the Federal Reserve, etc.
Right.
And then going down that list to where we are at the very bottom, from landed gentry, those are now the big bankers. What was the clergy's role is now the corporate elite. Royal ministers are now elected officials like our president and everybody else down at the bottom. That's a beautifully simple description of what we've come to. So we don't have any power to change this. It seems to be the mechanics of what you've described here.
Right. Well, I think we do have power, but that really lies in numbers, and that is dependent on education. And there's obviously roadblocks to this. The mass media is owned by very few people, and most of what we see is totally controlled. There is some flexibility on the Internet, and I think at this point that's what we have to work with. You know, I'm an optimist. You know, I believe that we can do this, but you have to know the conditions first that you're facing before you can come up with a workable strategy.
When you talk about what we're faced with, it sounds like you're suggesting that what we really need to overcome is what you call the tyranny of our own instincts and our ego.
Yes. Well, if you look at the people at the top of the system and the types of things that they're doing, and again, because it's so timely, we can look at Greece and, you know, seeing how that country's being shut down and forced into debt slavery. The basis of this is all really greed and power and those instincts. And that's just part of who we are. You know, I'm not trying to set this up like these sociopaths that are involved in doing this are any different than me or what I would be capable of had I been subject to different conditions in my own life and upbringing. So we need to see it that way spiritually, but on the other hand, we also need to get past this, and that's what we're seeing.
Who has the power in that process? It's personal, is that right?
Yes, it always begins with each of us. You know, as someone who's done yoga for 46 years, I'd have to say there's no getting around our individual responsibility for our own development. And that's exactly right. And there's, you know, lots of practices out there that can help people do this. But I think that's really where it starts.
And so what was the trajectory then for this evolution if the powers that be are operating a pretty closed system of control?
Mm-hmm.
How do individuals break through?
Well, other than just our own work on this, it's funny, as someone who studied political science and economics back in college, people occasionally ask me, you know, well, who's the guy that you look to? And I tell them Charles Dickens. And that always surprises them, of course, because people don't see him as a social theorist. But, you know, Dickens, of all the great works that he did, his favorite book was A Christmas Carol. And if you look at this book, the main character, Ebenezer Scrooge, we're all familiar with them. We tend to look at him as a, you know, negative force, also saying, you know, if the poor can't hold their weight, then they ought to just die to reduce the surplus population. But the key thing about Ebenezer Scrooge is he has an epiphany. And I think that after dealing with our own selves in terms of a consciousness and awareness and overcoming our instincts and our ego, what we become then are these ghosts, Marley and the ghosts of Christmas past, present, and future, that confront Ebenezer Scrooge, who you'll recall, particularly in the book, it's obvious he's a usurer from the city of London. And we are his conscience, and we need to stand up to this small group of people controlling the planet and create the conditions where they have an epiphany.
As you point out, you know, our consciousness is what is leading the possibilities for us in all instances.
Right.
And if we are comfortable about acquiescing to the powers that be, then, you know, enjoy your ride down the hill. You'll get to the bottom.
Yes, or if I could just throw in a quote from Samuel Adams. He put it exactly what you're talking about. If ye love wealth greater than liberty, the tranquility of servitude greater than the animating contest for freedom, go home from us in peace. We seek not your counsel nor your arms. Crouch down and lick the hand that feeds you. May your chains set lightly upon you, and may posterity forget that ye were a countryman.
Thank you, Bob.
You're welcome, Walt. Thank you.
That's Bob Bowes, author, economic historian, and philosopher. You can read more about his work at coloradopublicbanking.blogspot.com. That does it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. If you'd like to stay current with Ellen's writing and commentary, visit ellenbrown.com. And if you'd like to know more about public banking and related developments around the country, please visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Visit them on Facebook and follow on Twitter at Public Banks Now. Our thanks to our guests today, and especially to our committed sponsors at Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services, dedicated to economic justice and fairness and the creation of new American public banks. Payment Management offers complimentary analysis of your current credit card needs and expenses at paymentmgmt.com. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. Thanks for listening, and see you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.